I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Peter Franchot has served as Maryland's comptroller since 2007 after beating political legend William Donald Schaefer in a tight three-way primary race. Now, Franchot is running for a fourth term, and he's my guest today as our series of conversations with the candidates continues. Franchot is a Democrat, but he regularly sides with Republican Governor Larry Hogan in disputes with the Democratic legislative leadership, whom Franchot has referred to as a corrupt machine. They've tangled over everything from the beer business to school construction, and they disagree strongly about what the proper authority of the Board of Estimates should be. Peter Franchot joins me for the hour when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a nice weekend. Today, another in our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is Comptroller Peter Franchot. He's been the state's fiscal chief since 2007 after beating the incumbent at the time, William Donald Schaefer, in a primary. He faces Republican Anjali Reed Pukan of Worcester County in the November election. As comptroller, Franchot is a member of the powerful Board of Public Works in Annapolis, and he's the vice chair of the state retirement and pension system. Franchot is a Democrat who does not always toe the party line. His relationship with the legislative leadership in Annapolis, fellow Democrats Senate President Thomas Mike Miller and House Speaker Mike Bush, has seemed increasingly frayed this year. Franchot does have a close working relationship with Republican Governor Larry Hogan. Before becoming Maryland's top fiscal officer, Mr. Franchot served in the House of Delegates for two decades, representing the 20th District in Montgomery County. That district reaches roughly from Tacoma Park north to Colesville. Peter Franchot is 70 years old. He and his wife, Ann, live in Tacoma Park, and they have two grown children. We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page, and a little bit later in the program, we'll take your questions via email or Twitter or telephone. Peter Franchot, welcome to Midday. It's good to see you.
It's great to be here, Tom. And let me start by giving you one of my much coveted comptroller medallions. You're not really a member of the press. You are a master raconteur and discoverer of what makes people tick. But you're also a choral director, and I just want to give you one of my medallions
for everything
that you represent.
A comptroller medallion.
I've given that to governors and ambassadors and all sorts of
Well, that's very nice. I'll admit I didn't bring a gift for you. I apologize. one gift that you have the option of bestowing on somebody is an endorsement in the race for governor. You have a close relationship with Governor Larry Hogan. That's well known, and it's been going on for Mr. Hogan's first term. But you're, of course, a Democrat with a history of being a progressive Democrat. Do you intend to endorse Ben Jealous for governor this time around?
Well, let me just start, if I could, just by thanking the voters, because many hundreds of thousands of them voted for me. I was the top vote getter in the Democratic primary, which was last week. And I'm very grateful for that. It's a privilege to be the comptroller, not to toot my own horn, but not only am I popular with my own Democrats statewide, I'm also just as popular with the Republicans and the independents. I don't see that as a conflict. I see that as a badge of honor because it shows, I think, that I'm connecting with the voters on issues that matter to them. I have a couple of comments about the elections last week. Number one, in Baltimore City, the election turned out to be, well, in the entire state, it was somewhat of a fiasco because we had 90,000 plus people that were not properly registered based on the technology. And I bring that up not to blame anyone, but simply to say that—
Well, they had to cast provisional ballots, those who tried to change their registration or their address without making a purchase at an MVA office had their ballots.
Yeah, and I don't mean to bore your listeners with getting down the weeds, but something like this always seems to happen. And I think it affected 27,000 people that had to fill out a provisional ballot. Trust me, that's like chasing Alice down the rabbit hole because it's just inconvenient. It's complicated. It shouldn't have happened. It's unacceptable in a state like Maryland. Every time there's an election statewide, there seems to be something like this. It was Baltimore County 4 years ago where they didn't have enough scanners. So people would vote, and then they would have to wait for 2 hours in a line to actually verify their ballot. So I hope that...
Well, here in Baltimore County, again, we're going to have to wait until next week to find a winner in the race for county executive.
Exactly.
Right now, it's literally a few dozen votes separate Johnny Olszewski Jr. And Senator Jim Brochin. And again, it's because they're counting these provisional ballots. But of course,
the ballots will be counted.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have any assumption that somehow votes are not going to be counted ultimately.
Hmm. No, the votes will be counted. I just am always stunned in a wealthy state like Maryland why we always have something screw up in our election. For example, people that showed up at one of the polling places in Baltimore, the machines were locked in a back room somewhere. I mean, can't we just get that right, perhaps? Because I'm not suggesting there's anything nefarious there. It's just that they're completely avoidable incidents of people dropping the ball, and it has a corrosive effect, I think, on people who want to come out and vote, et cetera. So I'm concerned about that. I was very pleased to see here in Baltimore City that three new up-and-coming rising star Democrats, all of whom I supported, are now headed down to Annapolis, I think.
Corey McCray. We've got Mary Washington, whose race has not been called yet, but she is certainly ahead of Senator Joan Carter Conway.
Well, that's significant because Mary Washington, I heavily supported, endorsed, contributed to, knocked on doors with. She's a rising star in the Democratic Party. She defeated Joan Carter Conway, who is the top lieutenant for Mike Miller. And you mentioned in your opening that I have my disagreements with Mike Miller. I happen to believe that power tends to corrupt. I think absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think Mike Miller has absolute power. We as Democrats have an obligation to move him into retirement and deal with this situation with the Annapolis kind of machine. But Mary Washington is a star. She's going to be independent of Miller. She's going to represent her citizens. She's not going to do what Miller tells her to do necessarily unless it's in the best interest of her citizens. Corey McCray, you mentioned, another high-energy, wonderful progressive
legislator. You also mentioned Delegate Antonio Hayes.
And Delegate Antonio Hayes. I wasn't particularly involved in his election, but I think they—
Senator Robinson, you know, who was appointed to that seat when Mayor Catherine Pugh became the mayor of Baltimore.
Yeah, I don't mean to get into a long-winded discourse about the election, but I think there are indications that the public wants change. They're not sure all the time exactly how to get it, but it's going to happen. Out in Baltimore County, I supported Jim Brochin for county exec. He and Johnny Olszewski got two-thirds of the Democratic primary vote, and the third person, I believe
Vicky
it was
Almond.
Vicky Almond, was clearly the candidate of the status quo. But the other two-thirds of Democratic primary voters were voting for change. So that's terrific. And I'm very hopeful about that. And there are people all over the state that I supported, like David Blair, who is running for county exec in Montgomery County, very still close race to be decided. Jesse Colvin over on the shore. He's an Army, former Army Ranger, who's a fabulous candidate.
He'll be running against Andy Harris in the congressional district there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's very exciting for me. Ben Jealous is the somewhat surprised nominee of the party because
another candidate who was not supported by the establishment, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Everybody in the establishment, except for me, I guess, rallied around Rashearn Baker. I didn't get involved in that, but I certainly think that Ben spent an enormous amount of time and energy contacting voters and particularly plugging into what you just said, people that are looking for alternatives to the status quo. So the question of getting together with him and understanding what his specific proposals are, that's something that I would like to do. I'd like to have my agency do what it does for any gubernatorial nominee, which is allow him access to obviously open economic data that we have that where he can get better briefed on the economy in Maryland and what impact some of his proposals might have. So I'm excited about moving forward and hearing Ben's ideas. But I do want to be very clear with the voters in the state. I have a unique position on the Board of Public Works. It's a fiscal position. It's one that where it's necessary for me to really get along with whoever the governor is. And I happen to have a very strong and productive working relationship with Governor Hogan. And even more than that, he's a friend of mine. So I'm looking at this race as one, unlike the other Democratic races, up and down the ticket where I'm going to be looking for good, independent-minded, fiscally moderate Democrats to support, and we'll be working to get them elected. I think on the governor's race, because of my position on the Board of Public Works and because of my relationship with Governor Hogan that has focused around a lot of issues we can talk about if you want to, that the state has been improved by due to our kind of bipartisan work together. I think I'm probably going to be neutral in that race simply because it's important for me to be able to get along with whoever is elected.
It's kind of ironic, actually. Back in 2006, when you were in a very tight three-way race in the Democratic primary, in which the incumbent at the time, William Donald Schaefer, he'd already served as governor. He was term limited there. He'd served two terms as comptroller. It was you and Janet Owens, who was a county executive at the time. You challenged Mr. Schaefer on the basis of partially that he was a little too chummy with Robert Ehrlich, the Republican governor at the time. Do you see any parallels between how people characterize your relationship with Governor Hogan and, say, Mr. Schaefer's fairly good relationship with Governor Ehrlich?
Yeah, all I can point to is the fact that Governor Hogan and I have worked on issues. They don't get a lot of coverage because they're kind of boring to the press, but we together on the Board of Public Works have significantly reformed the procurement process on our votes for over, I think we vote on about $10 billion in contracts every year. Every 2 weeks we meet and vote on average $450 million in state spending. We've completely reformed that process to eliminate single bid contracts, or at least significantly reduce them. What does that do? That allows competitive bids to be made. It allows hundreds of millions of dollars to be saved by taxpayers. It helps small businesses because they get a sense to procurement systems on the level. There are areas like that. And then, of course, one that's near and dear to my heart, school after Labor Day, they told me over and over again in Annapolis, the machine did, that it's not going to happen because there are 1,000 bad ideas. Well, there was one good idea why it should. It's good for teachers, it's good for families, it's good for kids, and it's good for the economy. And Governor Hogan stepped in and did that by executive order. So is it somewhat ironic? Because, I criticize Schaefer also for endorsing President Bush, remember? But yeah. I'm not endorsing someone. I'm just simply saying for the betterment of the state, I think it's I put my state interest ahead of my party interest right now on this particular race. However, I'm happy to meet with Ben Jealous and whatever it is that he might need that's appropriate from our agency. I'm happy to give it to him so that he's able to be informed about the proposals that he wants to make.
It is an interesting moment in national politics, given the ascendancy of Donald Trump as the face of the Republican Party, or at least a certain faction of the Republican Party. You mentioned Cory McCray, Antonio Hayes, Mary Washington, progressive delegates moving up, if you will, to the Senate, which will change the complexion of the Senate in January quite substantially. It begs the question, what does it mean to be a Democrat today?
I have a good answer.
You look nationally, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez unseating Joe Crowley in the Bronx and Queens. Mr. Crowley thought to be perhaps an heir apparent to Nancy Pelosi. I mean, a senior leadership person, younger, progressive people making their way through the ranks. And Ben Jealous, another progressive candidate. What does it mean to you to be a Democrat? What do you think?
Well, I'm very proud to be a Democrat. I'm someone who believes Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Jack Kennedy. I was alive when Jack Kennedy was alive. you know, these are fabulous presidents and wonderful, we're a wonderful party in the Democratic Party, and we've got great values and principles. We have a president right now who is terrible, and he's not a good person. He's very, very mean, and he's, you know, very effective at dividing the country and benefiting from that kind of rhetoric that he specializes in. So what do I think the Democratic Party should emphasize? I think they should emphasize, number one, we're showing up and speaking to our voters and listening to our voters, whatever office you hold. Number two, we're going to do our best to actually do our job rather than spend a lot of our time just feathering our own nest. We're going to, you know, basically try to get things accomplished and at whatever level of government we're in. Third, we're going to be fiscal moderates. Why do I say that? That's what most of our voters are. They're fiscal moderates. They don't want higher taxes. They don't want higher fees. They don't want pie-in-the-sky programs that sound great but are completely or very likely completely unaffordable. And then fourthly, they want elected officials who can work together. And I've provided my voters in Maryland with that, and they've responded with a lot of affirmations. I'm not invulnerable. I do think that the defeat of Crowley shows that the Democrats around the country, like the Republicans, want change. The problem nationally is Trump, because he's poised to make a Supreme Court appointment that will take us backwards as far as civil rights and possibly Roe v. Wade. And I think that's completely unacceptable and wrong. But that is specific to Trump. And I tell my folks in the Democratic Party in Maryland, you know, the Marylanders that are Republicans, they're just poorly led right now. And they're really good people. They're just like us. And they have the same kind of, what they call them, the kitchen economic issues, I guess. And so I urge the Democrats to turn back to our voters, not with big, bold, visionary proposals that can never become reality. And if they did, would bankrupt the state. Why don't we just focus on making government work, answering the phone? Not a bad idea if you're a government bureaucracy. Get on the phone and help people solve their problems.
Peter Francho is completing his third term as the Comptroller of Maryland. Before being elected to that office, Mr. Francho represented Montgomery County in the House of Delegates for 20 years. We're going to take a quick break. We'll have more with Peter Francho. We'll take your questions, calls, and comments. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To follow us on Twitter, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWYPR. And you can, of course, also catch us right now on the WYPR Facebook page. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We'll talk about the press and public trust in the aftermath of a killer's murderous rampage at the Capitol Gazette in Annapolis last Thursday. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, Peter Francho is my guest. He has been Maryland's comptroller for 11 years. He is now seeking a fourth term. His opponent in the November election is a CPA from Worcester County, Republican Anjali Reed Pukan. You are welcome to be part of our conversation. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Mr. Francho, the Daily Record's Brian Sears has just tweeted and says that you've just, you know, mentioned that you're going to remain neutral probably in the governor's race. Mr. Sears says that on the 9th of April, a couple months ago, I asked you if you'd endorse Governor Larry Hogan, and you replied, "I'm a Democrat. I support Democrats." When we talk about bipartisanship, when we talk about working together, you've had some very harsh things to say about the Senate leadership, Senate President Miller and the head of the House, Mike Bush. You mentioned the progressive folks in the Democratic Party who've been elected, who may not be as compliant with Mr. Miller's wishes in the new term. When it comes to getting things done, when it comes to moving the ball forward, aren't you going to need to repair the relationship that you appear to have with Messrs. Miller and Bush in order to get legislative action?
Well, let me just respond to my good friend Brian Sears by saying, hey, I'm a Democrat. I'm not a robot. And generally, I do. And that's why I made it clear today that I support Democrats. But I don't support Democrats carte blanche up and down the ticket. I'm going to go and support people that I think are completely unacceptable as far as public service. That's why I've picked out people like Jesse Colvin and Mary Washington, Corey McRae, Jake Day down in the mayor of Salisbury, and there are people all over the state, Democrats, that I will be supporting. But they've got to be independent of the machine. They've got to be fiscal moderates, and they've got to be people that have the stature and the objectivity to get out and solve people's problems, whether they're Democrats, Republicans, or independents who are asking for their help. You asked about the machine. No, the machine is broken. It's wounded badly.
And by the machine, you're talking about Mike Miller and Mike Bush.
Exactly. And they're, you know, I served with them for 20 years. And, you know, people from Montgomery County like me kind of look away from the things that go on behind closed doors and back rooms down there in Annapolis. But you can't do it anymore because that saying that I said of absolute power corrupting absolutely, it has taken hold down there in Annapolis. And we need to move the leadership with their top lieutenants. We need to move them out and bring in these new young independent Democrats who are not going to be as partisan and vindictive and counterproductive for the citizens as the current machine is.
And I'm not pledged to work against Miller and Bush in the primary.
Well, not
will you
only
work
that,
against
I
them in the general election. Do you support their opponents?
No,
in the general
I will
election?
Not support Republicans against Democrats in the general election. But I am saying that we had a significant success in the primary of weakening the machine, and we need to continue to vigilantly hold them accountable. Because what happens, I know we're going to talk about craft beer in a minute. It doesn't affect politicians like me that they seek to punish and retaliate with all sorts of last-minute amendments and revisions. That doesn't bother me at all. What they hurt is the state of Maryland because they allow their personal petty grievances and their political kind of disputes. They allow that to take over their policy, and they hurt Maryland, and they hurt Maryland small businesses like the craft beer industry because they're irritated with my independence. Well, get used to it. I'm going to hopefully be around for another 4 years. And, you know, I'm not stopping one bit. And I think the force of progress and the force of change, which I mentioned in all of these local elections, is going to sweep through Annapolis.
Let's talk about craft beer. Before we do, let me sneak in one question that we have from a listener who gets in touch with us through Facebook. Dale says, what is your stand on awarding state contracts to companies and their subcontractors that don't e-verify their employees?
Well, I don't know whether that's a state policy that they do that. I have no problem with the employers of the state verifying that their employees are appropriate, legal, and proper. And so I'm not quite sure what the person is referring to there, but that's probably something the legislature should be approached with rather than me.
All right. Well, confess I don't know anything about that particular issue either. Let's talk about the craft beer industry. You had something called Reform on Tap legislation. Before we talk about the specifics of that legislation, there's a certain contingent in Annapolis that says, look, you're the comptroller. You should be collecting the taxes. You should be serving as the fiscal officer of the state. And to be involved in any particular way with legislation of any sort and legislative initiatives is inappropriate for a comptroller. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's just a bunch of nonsense. I am the elected comptroller, the chief fiscal officer of the state. I handle 3.4 million tax returns a year. We handle 800,000 phone calls from taxpayers who have important questions about federal and state taxes. My experts in the agency provide most of the revenue forecasting. We're intimately involved with the governor and the legislative leaders on all things fiscal. I happen to be given the authority to regulate alcohol, the state alcohol laws in the state. I didn't know that before I got elected, but that's the fact. I do it. I've got a 35-person enforcement agency, which is the best in the country, and we regulate the alcohol industry very vigilantly for abiding by the state's laws. Does that give me the knowledge to make recommendations? Absolutely. Is there a conflict? No. I am an absolutely vigorous regulator, and I will continue to be. But I can also bring to the attention of the legislature that we have atrocious state laws that are heavily based on economic protectionism that are very onerous for this wonderful craft brewing industry. By the way, 4th of July is coming up, day after tomorrow. I hope everybody enjoys the hot weather with a cold craft Maryland beer. This is a sector that is busting out all over the state. I was up here cutting the ribbon on a small new brewery checker spot down near Camden Yards. But, you know, recently, one of the most vigorous new craft brewers just announced in Annapolis he's getting up and moving to Philadelphia because he's fed up with the state legislature being in the pocket of Budweiser and Coors Miller and other out-of-state beer companies getting in the way of his business. So he, an Annapolis Naval Academy grad, a wonderful guy, Alan Beal, said, hey, we're moving our production up to Philadelphia because we can't operate our business here.
So the bill that
it would have corrected all of his problems.
Okay, and so what sorts of problems are we talking about? You're saying that the current legislation favors the large beer makers, the Budweisers, the Coors of the world, in favoring those large institutions, it works to the detriment of the small creppers. So in what ways and what would your legislation do?
Yeah, I don't think that. I know that because I'm the regulator of alcohol, and I know that the out-of-state beer companies own these committees that overlook the alcohol issues, lock, stock, and barrel. It is a disgrace, the open, accountable, transparent, honest government. And the way they do it is they pass laws. They say, okay, you can have a craft brewery in Maryland, but you can only operate your tap room on certain hours. And why is that significant? Well, when you have a craft brewery that you open up, your initial revenue comes from your taproom sales, where you're only allowed to sell the beer you produce with your employees and your equipment and your ingredients. But it's not like a bar or tavern. It's a taproom at your brewery. By limiting that and controlling that, they're able to scare off the kind of investment that these folks are making. Flying Dog recently announced a $54 million expansion in Frederick. They're canceling it because under the state law, their brewery out in Frederick, if they expand it, it's considered to be a new brewery and would have all these limitations that the legislature recently put on it. Legislature blames me and says, oh, well, I'm too fire and brimstone and too much of a advocate or whatever. I mean,
well, they're saying that you're favoring the craft industry over the other, the wholesalers and the retailers of liquor and beer and wine here in Maryland. So we're talking about 84 craft brewers as opposed to, I don't know how many hundreds of people who are in the other end of the alcohol sales business. So that's their argument.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense at all because all of those people will sell more beer. It'll just be Maryland beer. they'll make more money. A rising tide lifts all boats. But they're all in bed with each other down there. So it's really, it's not them. They are working on behalf of Budweiser and these big companies because nobody wants Budweiser anymore. Nobody likes Miller beer anymore. Nobody likes Coors beer. So these big behemoths are telling their allies in Maryland, you have to snuff out the craft beer because that's what people really want. And we do not want to have that competition unless we own them. And they often will buy a craft brewery. But that's the issue. It's economic protectionism and new entrants versus an entrenched political machine. I mean, you talk about Mike Miller and Mike Bush. Yeah,
this bill died in the House Economic Matters Committee, 17-4, in a bipartisan opposition. There's some people who say this is a get back to you because of your opposition to them on to the leadership of the House and the Senate and other matters. Do you think this has any connection to personal animus?
Oh yeah, definitely. It was clearly punishment and retaliation directed at me. Who did they punish though? All of these wonderful family-owned Maryland businesses that are producing almost $1 billion in economic activity. So nice job, Economic Matters Committee. And by the way, there are a few dead bodies of your former legislators lying around the state of Maryland right now from the election. So, or not dead, let's pick another term, out of work legislators. And, you know, I don't really care what they say and do about me. I've been in this environment for a long time, but I can promise you that House Bill 518 is going to pass next year, or there's going to be more ramifications as far as what happened up in New York with the Crowley person that you mentioned in the beginning of this.
So you will introduce the legislation next year, and you think your chances are pretty good?
I know that the legislation is going to be introduced by the craft brewers. I'm going to be on a little bit out of the line of fire, but I will be there with everything I have defending that legislation. I'm pretty convinced that it will pass. And if it doesn't, there are going to be some changes.
My guest is the Comptroller of the State of Maryland, Peter Franchot. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. Mr. Comptroller, let me sneak in an email from Paul in Clarksville, who says, my wife and I are retirees who are finding ourselves hit hard by the Trump tax cuts, in quotes. I was disappointed that the Maryland legislature punted on delivering on Governor Hogan's promise not to have taxpayers pay more taxes to Maryland due to changes in the federal tax code. I'm actually expecting many people to be very upset next year when they pay their taxes because I suspect that not enough is being withheld and they will owe more than they anticipated at tax time. But that will be after the next election. What are your thoughts on this issue?
Well,
this is something that the legislature did take up. Do you think they addressed it adequately?
Well, first of all, my agency did something no other state did, which is right after the conference committee on the tax cut, we ran 2.5 million real Maryland tax returns from tax year 2014 through our system in a simulation of what the federal tax cut was. And we came up with all the figures of 71% of the people would benefit from the federal tax cut. 26% of the people had to pay higher state taxes because of the deduction issue that may be what your emailer is citing. But overall,
do those numbers hold up, do you think?
Oh, yeah, they were absolutely spot on because they were real numbers. They weren't some kind of partisan speculation.
These are 2014 tax returns, as if they were being filed in 2019 when this all goes into effect at the federal level. And you still believe that 71% of Marylanders will pay less in federal tax, but will they pay more? But many of them will pay more in state tax.
On a net basis, only 6% of Maryland taxpayers are going to pay on a net basis after the federal tax cut and even if they have a state tax increase. So half of those turned out to be business people with significant business losses because they amended that. The other half are kind of a gaggle of folks that have specific interests. Your emailer should contact our office so we can take a look at that, but we're happy to send him the report. We were the first state in the country to do it. The legislature we gave it to the legislature and to the governor, and it articulated about $400 to $500 million in windfall revenues for the state of Maryland. I urge them not to spend it. Don't commit it. Put it in the rainy day fund. We don't know what's going to happen down the road. There might be a counterproductive recession down the road because we're stimulating the economy so much. We just don't know. They went ahead and returned, I believe, $80 million to the citizens, and they have committed the rest to various programs. But we'll just see how it comes out. I thought it was very healthy that the governor said return it to the taxpayers so the legislature couldn't just take all of it and spend it immediately. It's somewhat in play right now, I think, for next year. So depending on what happens to the economy, some of that may still be returned to the taxpayers, and I would certainly support that.
Peter Francho is Maryland's comptroller. He'll be with me for the rest of the hour. He's seeking a fourth term as the state's fiscal chief. You are welcome to join us when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780, or email midday@wypr.org to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we take a break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and their friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has compiled a list of Baltimore homicide victims going back 17 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list of homicides, which they've been keeping since 2007, as well as the Baltimore Police Department's Facebook page. So far in 2018, 136 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, there were no homicides reported in Baltimore. One victim from the previous week has now been identified by police. He is Joey Roscoe. He was 38 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, it's another in our series of conversations with the candidates. Peter Francho is my guest here in Studio A. He is Maryland's comptroller, having been elected to that post for the first time in 2006. He's been reelected twice since then, and he is on the ballot again this November. His opponent is a CPA from Worcester County, Anjali Reed Poucan. Mr. Francho is the state's 33rd comptroller. Should he win and complete another term, that would bring his tenure to 16 years in the office. Only Louis Goldstein, who served for nearly 40 years, and William Gordy, who served from 1922 to 1939, have held the office longer. Mr. Francho is a Democrat. The last time a Republican was elected as comptroller was in 1898. Mr. Francho oversees an agency of 1,100 people and a budget of $110 million. He is able and willing to take your calls, your comments here on Midday. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Mr. Francho, the Supreme Court just last week ruled in a case allowing sales taxes to be collected online. This differed from state to state. It looks like it's going to be codified. What does that mean for Maryland? What does that mean for projected revenues next year, 2 years, 5 years out?
Yeah, this is an extraordinary boost to the state's retail economy. These are family-owned businesses generally on Main Street that pay rent, pay utilities, hire accountants and lawyers and employees, and they're wonderful participants in our state's economy. They're getting ravaged and pillaged by these out-of-state, remote internet behemoths. Amazon just recently started paying us sales tax on goods that go through their distribution facility near Baltimore. That's good. I'm not allowed to tell you how much money it is. It's a god-awful amount of money that they collect and remit to me from the 6% sales tax where it's appropriate. The Supreme Court decision has opened up the possibility that all of the remote internet sales like Wayfair and others are going to have to do the right thing and collect and remit the sales tax to the Comptroller of Maryland for items that they deliver in the state. Is this a tax increase? No, it isn't. It is simply the lawful extension of an existing tax. It is absolutely indispensable to protect our mom-and-pop retailers on Main Street. I am very grateful for the Supreme Court reversing itself in this recent decision, and we are right now in the process of promulgating regulations, and we are going to implement it quicker, sooner. I'm not sure, Tom.
Estimate about how much money we're talking about? Potentially?
Yeah, hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm not exactly sure whether this is a panacea for all small businesses, because a lot of the internet is used, I think, by people for convenience. But that 6% sales tax omission for out-of-state internet companies, that's not going to exist anymore. And we're going to get a lot more from Amazon because they're just because they had a distribution facility, they weren't collecting from their other folks that are on their platform. So this is a good, proper move by the court. They made a mistake back in the mid-90s. They've now corrected it, and it's entirely appropriate.
I guess you're in conversation with the Attorney General's office here in Maryland to find out whether or not this requires any legislative action, or do you think you can just start collecting the tax tomorrow?
We believe we have the right under the regulations to promulgate it and act on it immediately with, hopefully, the Attorney General agrees with us, and I believe he would or should. And so we're pretty solid in our thought that we can move quickly within the next month.
Let's go to the phones. Lafayette in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Comptroller Peter Franco.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, sir. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Tom and Mr. Comptroller. I want to ask, has anyone done an audit, or can anyone give us a figure showing the benefits of the tax incentives that and tax cuts that businesses and business receives when they want to come to Maryland? I'm sure it must be in the millions or possibly the billions, and we never hear of any benefit. No one ever talks about the benefits that arise from these tax incentives that we give.
Okay, well, thanks, Lafayette, for that call. I think Lafayette's probably referring to TIFs here in Baltimore City, for example, the Port Covington development with Under Armour, that kind of thing. What's your view of tax incentives, be they from the state? We have a proposal to Amazon, which is still being considered now, to place their second headquarters here. What's the role of government when it comes to enticing people to come here?
Well, we don't want to hand out money to people just because it's a bake-off or an auction. But in the case of Amazon, we're talking 50,000 jobs. It's a game changer for the state's reputation and for its employment. So I'm in support of that rather mammoth offering of infrastructure aid in the billions of dollars. I think Lafayette has a very good point that we should be vigilant and have oversight and make sure that whatever arrangement we enter into with a corporation, certainly the obligations of the that are made in the arrangement as far as employment and contributions to the local revenue, all of that should be monitored very closely. And there are clawback provisions in most of the state laws that say if a company comes in, gets a grant from the state, but then doesn't follow through on its commitment and/or moves, the state can claw back the incentive. Do we have to compete with other states? Absolutely. We would just get zeroed out if we didn't get in the arena, at least be competitive. We'll see how everything works out.
Let's go to Mark in Catonsville. Mark, welcome to Midday with Peter Franco.
Hi there. Glad to be on your show. I'd like to, first of all, hi, Mr. Comptroller. Good to talk to you. In your opening remarks, you kind of referred to big, expensive programs that people don't want to pay for, and I just want to challenge that a little bit. I was involved heavily in this latest campaign, and I heard a lot about what people really wanted, particularly in education. expensive things, new schools, more teachers, et cetera. And I think people do want to pay for it. They want to see their money spent correctly. I'm with you there. But I think people do want more spending from government effectively. Maybe they don't like paying for it, but they do want the services.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Mark. I mean, we are in a time now, obviously, that when it comes to revenue for the state of Maryland, it's a cyclical thing. It goes up, it goes down. Right now, we're a little flush. We're a little more flush than we've been in years past. What's your estimate for revenues here in fiscal 19, the year the revenue fiscal year just started yesterday, right, here in Maryland? I mean, what's your understanding of what we'll be looking at when the legislature reconvenes in January?
Well, we're predicting in the comptroller's office, our experts are predicting a good year for local and state tax revenues in the state of Maryland in 2018. They immediately, the experts, turn around and say, but we are turbocharging an economy that's almost at full employment in Maryland with all of these tax cut returns and also even the refunds that we're returning. I think together it's almost $6 billion in new disposable income that's been put into pockets of Marylanders. The concern there is that it's going to cause a lot of interest rate rises. There's going to be a lot of recessionary pressures to as a result in the next calendar year. So I'm suggesting that people really go slow as far as being hugely supportive of new programs based on the revenues that admittedly there's a windfall. Your caller, though, made it obviously a very heartfelt point about education. Everybody wants new schools and everybody wants new teachers, and teachers deserve more money. Of course, that's the case. But we have to make sure we can pay for it. We're not the federal government where we can just print money down in some basement and turn it out. We have to be fiscally moderate. Otherwise, we're going to lose our contact with our voters.
We have an email from Greg who says, I've looked for reports on data on the financial impact of starting schools after Labor Day and the impact on the Maryland economy. Where did you get your information to support this change? I believe your source was North Carolina schools. The three areas I looked at were Charlotte, Wilmington, and Lexington. They all start before Labor Day. Joining us on the phone is Maryland State Senator Jim Mathias from Ocean City. Senator, we just have about a minute left. Welcome to the program, and what's your comment, sir?
Good afternoon, Tom. Good afternoon, Mr. Comptroller. I wanted to thank the Comptroller for his leadership on this issue. We worked together with a task force. We studied the issue. We were very fortunate to work with Governor Hogan. He signed an executive order, and I've been the mayor of Ocean City for a long-term mayor, and I just want to thank him. And the data is clear, and it's sound, and the people of Maryland support it. And I support the Comptroller in his endeavor and look forward to continue working with him. Thank you, Mr. Comptroller.
Yes, Senator, thank you for that call. And
so now that we're a year in, I mean, are you convinced that the economic impact is either neutral or positive?
Well, I'm going to respond to your listener or your emailer. And if we don't have an economic study underway, I believe we do. We're already able to characterize this as a win for the state's economy. That's not the reason we did it. We did it for the teachers and the families and the kids who deserve to have a full summer break, and it's proven to be wildly popular. There would be an open civil revolt if the legislature or the next governor tried to reverse it. So it's right. I want to thank Senator Mathias for being a leader on that. He's a fellow Democrat, and he's done a lot of work on school after
right, and I want to thank you for your time. That is all the time we have. Comptroller Peter Francho, thanks so much, sir. Peter Francho is a Democrat. His Republican opponent in November is a CPA from Worcester County named Anjali Reed Pukan. I will be speaking with Ms. Pukan here on Midday later this summer. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. The killer who murdered five people at the Capitol Gazette last Thursday posted hateful comments on social media prior to his rampage that indicated deep resentment against the Capitol because of a column that the paper published about his conviction for harassing a former high school classmate. There are also some indications he was angry at the paper because of its criticism of President Trump. So we're going to talk about the connection between Mr. Trump's dismissive and hateful rhetoric about the press and the actions that we saw happen in Annapolis. That's coming up tomorrow, Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. They're open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. On behalf of the entire Midday team, thanks for listening. Have a great day.